It's Saturday, June 28th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 889 and KUSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Mr. Ben Jaffe, a web development instructor, musician, and world traveler.
Yo.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, since you're a world traveler, Ben, have you used the Google flight search system?
I've used a system that lets you search flight prices. So is this the same one or is this a new thing?
So it's a new thing. Google's been improving the search for flights. And you know how you can go onto some sites and like Expedia and things like that and find search deals and then get – or search flights and then you get the best price.
Well,
and
I can say when I used it maybe – I don't know, maybe a year ago, 6 months ago, something like that I was impressed at how fast it was because, you know, all of the...
Most of the time it's not fast.
It's like, you know, loading. Well, but it didn't make me think of anything. Like, it didn't seem new in any real way other than it was fast. And because it was fast, you could do a lot of different searches all really quickly and figure out, oh, you know what? Maybe I should fly out of Oakland instead of San Jose and go to Frankfurt instead of London. That's going to be my best price. So that was really great. But it didn't really make me say wow, really, other than just the speed. So
right. So they released it in 2011, then improved it in 2012. More recently, they've improved it even more. And the big deal about the search system, the flight search system, is that you can search by like time and region from your search location of your city that you want to fly from, and then you can get maps with prices on it. So it's kind of integrated in pretty well to show you like where you might want to go. So it's kind of a fun exploration thing on price.
That is kind of cool.
And of course, you can change the date ranges and things of that nature. The speed is the thing that really is getting it. In fact, the other companies, you know, there's a lot of companies that do this kind of thing, right? There's Orbitz and Travelocity and Priceline and things of that nature. They normally do the same service and then hope that you'll purchase through them and then they'll give you another deal for renting a car and a hotel and all that. But those things are actually relatively slow. And speed is kind of nice. I mean, it's nice.
It's really nice. Yeah, that's something I've always wanted is a tool where I could explore rather than just book from point A to point B. And that's usually what I do. Actually, I just want to give a plug for a company who I think really reinvented it in a big way. It's called HipMonk. And if you go on that website, they have a completely bizarre user interface. But once you learn how to use it, it's actually really neat. Like, you know, you can click and drag sliders.
You have
sliders.
To be relatively
time
private
goes,
and hip.
Well, I don't know. You have to be a chipmunk, actually. But time goes in the x-axis from left to right, and you can see all the flights as they stack up. You can see the length of the flights, and you can search by other things like the length of the flights or the comfort or any of these other things.
I thought you'd be up on this kind of stuff, being a world traveler and all.
Yeah. But at the same time, sometimes you get better deals other places, right?
Sure.
But I really like them, so.
All right, so since you and I are chatting real quick about Google, why don't you do that story about YouTube?
Google has been busy. Well, one of the things that they recently did is they just announced that they're adding two new features. So these are especially geared towards people who watch video games online and those who stream games online. So there's one, the option for people who are watching the videos to pay the video creators directly through YouTube. So that's kind of cool if you're a video creator. And two, 60 frames per second. So if you look at video is just a collection of images all shown very quickly in rapid succession. And usually you see 30 frames a second. If you go and watch a film, actually it's much worse temporal resolution. It's 24 frames per second.
Or more stylized.
Yeah, right. Exactly. When they were shooting The Hobbit, I think they did it. Might get the number wrong. It was something like 120 frames per second.
Wow.
Or something. So when you watched it, it looked like Real Motion, but because people have, it's been ingrained in people that film is good and cheap video on televisions, which has a higher frame rate, is bad. People watched The Hobbit and it looked like some cheap camcorder thing that someone made. And so,
I wouldn't say that The Hobbit looked like cheap camcorder, but I get your meaning.
Yeah,
there's
a style
about the higher frame rate.
Yeah, it just, it looks wrong. It doesn't look cinematic, right? That big word.
You know, we've been on Geekspeak a long time doing a lot of teaching for people about technology, and we've always kind of said that because of the 24 frames per second, the eye retains an image. There's a bit of a ghosting effect, and therefore you don't need more than that to get realistic motion. And there is
that's true.
So does 60 frames a second really matter?
I think it does. Well, I mean, in particular with video games, it does matter because then you see the I don't know, light laser ray thing zap the shooby dooby. What's it?
I don't know. It's one of those things for me that, you know, when you talk about fidelity and the human interaction, the boundary is not like it's your perception that matters, right? So,
yeah.
If you don't notice the difference between 30 frames and 60 frames, then why would you bother doubling your.
What's the frame rate on your computer screen? The refresh rate on your computer screen.
I don't know.
It's very
probably
high.
60
it's probably 60 or 80 or 120 or something like that. CRT monitors
but
are really
no,
big.
There's something
ones.
Very different about television screens in general and LCDs.
No, that's
they're
true.
Scanning.
That's true. There's a big difference between LCDs and TV screens. But when I was back in high school, there was a project. I was in this IT class. And I had to install Windows NT version 3.52, I think it was, without the help of the internet at all. I just had to literally get the disk, and that's all I had, and I had to kind of search around on that machine. I couldn't go to another machine. And the graphics card was at 52 frames per second on a CRT monitor, and it just looked like it was a strobe light in my face, you know? So, I mean, there are different paradigms or different ways that these different technologies work.
Sure. But you also might have been under fluorescent light, which would cause a secondary problem.
That's true.
But you know what? Maybe we should move on from resolution.
But the point is, when you're gaming on your computer, you're not looking at 30 frames a second. You're probably looking at a much higher refresh rate. Mm. And so if you're watching a video on YouTube and it's at 30 frames a second, you're watching less information, basically. So this is, I don't know. I think this is a win for the gaming community. Which I'm not really much of a part of.
I'm not sold.
I'm more of
Give me a comparison.
Oh, man.
Side to side, and then I'll maybe let's, go. Yeah, I can tell.
Let's make it a geek bit. You let's, can go, there's a 60
is there a comparison?
Second. Yeah, there's a
no,
a
but
video.
Is there a side to side comparison?
Side by side comparison? No,
yeah.
Maybe I can code
yeah, that's
one
the thing.
Up.
Actually, in reality, what I need is I need you to give me a 30 frames and a 60 frames, and don't tell me which one it is, and I'll see if I can tell. All right. Ben, thank you so much. This is Geek Speak with Ben and Lyle. Oh, actually, Miles is here, too. Hi, Miles.
Hi there.
You want to give us a story of the political nature, since you're a political junkie, sir?
Well, since we were talking about resolutions, the Supreme Court brought a decision down that brings resolution to the question of whether cops need a warrant to search a cell phone.
Okay.
This has always been a question at issue, especially ever since phones had the ability to have a camera on it.
Yeah.
With the flip phones, the feature phones.
There can be some incriminating data on that phone.
Right. And so this back and forth, the type of thing. And what the Supreme Court has found is, I thought, very astute, is that nowadays our smartphones have everything on it. They have access to our bank accounts. They have access
all the people we know.
Our journals, our Facebook accounts. We're talking about something.
So, sometimes they are the passwords to tons of other things that we don't use on our phone.
So your cell phone ends up being your life. If you don't have a protection on that, you don't have Fourth Amendment protection.
The Supreme Court said this?
Yes.
Yahoo!
Basically, we're saying, yeah, this is a major part of people's lives now. Yeah. We need to recognize that. And if you have a probable cause, then you get a warrant.
Cool. So cell phones now searched only via warrant. Now, of course, a cop could ask you, can I look through your phone?
Yes.
And you'd have to say no if you want the protection.
Right. And in fact, if a police officer wants to search your phone without a warrant, and they end up taking your phone and start to ruffle through it, you should vocally and audibly say, for you and others around to hear, but staying calm, I do not consent to this search of my phone.
Okay.
And
don't engage with trying to take the phone or anything. Just say that very clearly.
If you say nothing, then a police officer could argue that they asked you and you gave implied consent by not not saying anything.
Right. Yeah. And it's one of those things like...
It depends upon... The thing is, you can't get nonverbal responses very well. Most human communication is nonverbal, so there's a lot of wiggle room there.
Right.
So to take away that wiggle room, you have to actually vocalize, I do not give consent.
And it's also one of those things where the phrasing of the whole sentence to ask for the phone could be something like, hey, I'm going to look at your phone and then I'm going to let you go. You guys want to go, right? And now you're in the situation of like, wait a second. And if you said yes to that question, maybe you're inferring response to the first question. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely situations where you need to protect yourself by... So you just state very clearly, now, I do not consent to the search.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, this doesn't protect you from exigent circumstances, such as if the police feel that you are actively trying to wipe your phone or delete it or do stuff like that, where you're preemptively trying to tamper with evidence... Then there can be a reason for it. Or if there is a life-threatening situation where they need to have that information.
What about... So a police officer feels like they need to search your phone. So they say, I'd like to search your phone. You say, no, I don't consent to that. And they say, okay, I'm going to hold on to it until I get a judge. Like, can they remove it from your presence until they get a court order?
It depends upon... I'm not a lawyer, so I don't want to really give legal advice.
But anyways, there's probably situations in which a police officer could go into that pattern, right? So that it's not possible for the... person that postally has data on the phone to erase it.
I would assume, and once again, not legal advice, I would assume it has a lot to do with whether or not you are actively being detained or arrested. If you are arrested, yes, they can take your phone.
Right, of course. Of course. All right. Okay, so
I feel like this
cops
should be
must...
In,
sorry.
I feel like this should be in... well, the whole I do not give consent, I think that should be an opt in thing where they say, can you verbally say, yes, I can search your phone?
Well, there kind of is that, but it's hard to denote whether you accept or not if the action starts taking place. Like if I take your phone from you and I start looking through it and you've witnessed that whole thing, if you say nothing, that could be tacit consent. I might assume that.
That's true.
And if you have witnesses nearby, if you say, I do not agree to this.
But it could also be timidity, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like I would say I don't agree to this. You know, to the search, but I know a lot of people who probably would be like, I don't know what to do.
It's
right
tricky.
Now.
Yeah, and whatever you do, do not fight with the police. Don't try to take your phone away from them. Don't if a problem does arise with this,
I'm
work
curious.
It out later in the course. Do
so
not
this went to the Supreme
like,
Court
get into a fight because that's going to be a whole other
not good
can of worms.
So this went to the Supreme Court. What was the ruling ratio?
It was a 9-0.
Whoa.
Yeah, it
total.
Was a unanimous decision.
That's always nice.
That
now this
the
covers
Fourth Amendment
cell phones.
Absolutely applies.
This covers cell phones. Does it cover any personal electronic device? Like what if you have
there
like a
is
laptop?
A separate ruling that has come down that I don't know the stats on it right away, but that has to do more with if someone takes your laptop away from you and they keep it for several months, it's a slightly different ruling. That one is more along the lines of that is considered the equivalent of a general warrant. In other words, warrants are usually specific, saying I'm looking for this particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if your technology is taken away from you for months at a time so that it can be searched extensively, that means that it's no longer a specific search. It actually would fall under the same category as a general warrant.
All right. Thank you for the update on that. So two quick Google stories real quick. Google's been pretty good about being open and transparent about the inequality of gender and of race in their organization. And, you know, basically, as we've talked about many times on GeekSpeak, unfortunately, the ratio of women represented in the tech industry is much lower than in the population at large.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clearly a problem with our entire, it's a systemic system problem. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And whenever we talk about it, we get an email from someone saying, why are you talking about this? This isn't important.
That's why it's
a
problem?
Yes, which is exactly why we need to talk about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Google's been public about their internal data about their company, which is a pretty interesting thing to do. And of course, they're a data company. Sharing data is one of the things they suggest strongly. But additionally, they just started a program to allow grant funding for women in tech industry to get programming knowledge. Basically, paying for online classes for women to get their programming skills up to par. They're putting money on the table, which is nice.
This is the second big time, the time they put big money on the table for this. Yeah. So.
And actually, it's not just women. It actually is minorities who are disproportionately missing from the workforce.
Not represented. Okay.
But the vast majority of this is going to women, and rightly so. That's a huge segment of the population that is not being tapped.
Yeah. Now, if this isn't a long-term fix, right? Because taking an adult and retraining an adult to be in this industry is different than changing the system in place so that people, you know, comes up equally
right,
early on.
And
but
so kids,
I think it's a good way to make an important statement that this needs to happen and to get more women in programming.
Yeah, to get more women in programming.
And more diversity in programming, really. Right. It's not.
Yeah.
This is one area where I do have a strong feeling about the fact that in some areas you have construction or whatever that someone will say men are more apt for this role because there are some roles where you need the upper body strength that most women don't have or
sure.
or proportionally more men have
people
than
say
women,
that
type
uh-huh.
of thing. Yeah, but I mean, there are some areas that are like that. And programming is absolutely not one of those.
Right.
Programming
right.
is absolutely about how you can use your mind and how you can
and
figure out a problem.
What we've learned from
it
the
should be
history.
The great equalizer.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not.
And what we see in the history of software engineering in general is this new concepts come from different fields and it changes dynamically. And it's very clear that more diverse thinking works in that kind of environment. You get more out of it if you have a lot of different types of minds, right? So different historical perspectives, cultural perspectives are really important in making a strong programming community.
Yeah.
So,
and this is why Google, Yahoo, and now Facebook should be applauded for giving the demographic data for these large companies with thousands of workers.
To highlight the problem, right?
Right. Well, to get a good snapshot of it because, in fact, many of them do better than the general tech community. Like, this is not – they're not outliers that are worse than everyone. They're actually slightly better than the average.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another Google story.
Oh, yeah. Another quick, actually quite unrelated Google story, but related in that it's Google. They today, or not today, I'm sorry, reading the story, they revealed last week, at the end of last week, beginning of this week, that they are building a domain registration service, and they're calling it Google Domains, very inventive of them. But the idea is they're going to get into this domain selling and management industry. And one of their goals is to get more small businesses to have websites.
Right. We're talking about domain names, of course, like geekspeak.org, for example, which you can go to and learn about all the stories we were talking about today here on GeekSpeak. We'll be back in a minute talking about more, a little bit about privacy, actually, and other things here on GeekSpeak. You're listening to GeekSpeak here on KUSP. In the air with me is Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. I'm Lyle Troxell. We'll take calls from you with questions and comments about technology in another 10 minutes or so. The phone number is 888-777-1507. Again, that's 1-888-777-1507. And Rick Philman is standing by, but this is limited because Rick's moving away. So if you want to call in to GeekSpeak, now's your time to do it. Well, in about 10 minutes or so. All right, so we were talking about Google, and I want to get into a privacy conversation. I'll just mention one thing that was kind of interesting, and maybe we'll start this privacy discussion. Larry Page, the CEO and co-founder of Google, kind of in a New York Times article, kind of flippantly, I think flippantly, not flippantly, he probably plans everything he says, he's a pretty smart guy, but said that the idea is that if Google or other companies were able to mine personal private medical information, we could save lives. And he estimated the life saving is about 100,000 people a year. So if it is completely true that if we just simply anonymized to some degree and made public our medical records, we could save 100,000 lives a year, it seems like we should do that. You guys, what do you think?
Well, of course he would say that. I don't know. I mean, so yes, more data can mean more opportunities, more taking advantage of opportunities. Less data can mean less opportunities. For example, if I'm researching any business, I'll go onto Google Street View and I'll see what it looked like maybe a month ago or two months ago. And that information can be very, very useful. I can tell someone, oh, yeah, meet me at blah, 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 blah. It's across the street from the 7-Eleven or whatever, right? At the same time, there were a lot of privacy issues that cropped up with that. Now people aren't talking about it so much anymore. Google's gotten pretty good at blurring out faces and license plates and things like that. But that's not to say that that was necessarily the right or the wrong choice. It's not a black and white space at all.
I'm not sure about like large-scale data mining in general with medical information, how viable that is, because I think that that's a space that needs to be proven. There's a lot of complexity in doing that and gleaning data. But I do know that the current laws and regulations, FIFA, I think
HIPAA.
It's HIPAA, thank you, the Health and...
Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act.
Miles wins acronym of the day. That A-O-D. Law is makes data management really complicated for software engineers to deal with medical information. And then, therefore, because of that law and because of the structure around that, that protects people's privacy, valid reasoning, it is difficult to get data flowing back and forth easily. And if you don't give the right data to a healthcare worker, they can't make the right decision. So from that perspective of making that easier and more fluid, I could definitely see benefits and lives saved.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, you can, with a massive amount of data, what you do with that data is not look at individual people. You look for big patterns.
Yeah.
And you find these big patterns and you realize, oh, you know, well, see, 90% of the people with these symptoms were diagnosed with this. This person seems to have had the same symptom based on the, you know,
I get that theoretical idea that large data analysis allows you to figure out trends and possibly diagnose things that we didn't know about and lots of things. But what I'm saying is even at a more specific level, I know that it's hard for two different medical healthcare professionals to get data of the same person.
Oh, yeah.
An example of this is a midwife is doing a home birth or birth at a midwife center, right? They have all this information about the patient, right? About both the patients, have all this information and history about the patients. And then there's a problem, right? You get something, a breech birth, it's just going too long, it's just getting difficult. So you go to the hospital. So the healthcare worker is the hospital, patient comes in, brand new patient, no history, right? Because there's no way to get the data over because of these rules.
Because of the legal issues.
Because of the system in place. Not necessarily, the legal issues.
The system in place because of the legal issues.
Exactly. So what I'm saying is that right there needs to be addressed. And I think right now we're probably too close to the privacy support side than we could be.
I can't speak to the 100,000 number. I don't know if it's too low or too high. I
and
don't
he didn't
know anything
cite
about
any
that.
Rationale behind
There's
that.
No
he
number
just
well,
said
right.
that number.
Right.
Yeah. And I do believe that, yes, there's a lot of information that can be gained, and it can be gained safely. You can anonymize data. And the data is actually already out there. Insurance companies already have huge
That's
amounts
the corporations
of data that is
already have
there.
This about us, right?
Right, and hospitals as well. They have that demographic data. They have that treatment data. But and you're right. We don't have that over encompassing to see. Hey, is this hospital not prescribing this thing as a general pattern? Are the mortality rates better using this pattern than another that doesn't go for hospital, but it's, pan care provider, individual doctors that have specific goals or affiliations.
Sure.
Are they getting a better or worse outcome? But the fears about privacy, like what brought about HIPAA and the computer regulations associated with it, are not to be taken lightly. There's not only the danger of abuse with it, there is the history of demonstrated abuse.
Yeah.
Having access to this information.
People being
in the
discriminated.
Past of people who weren't given access to healthcare or health insurance, rather, because of it, or
ostracized in general.
Yeah, employers having different thoughts about it because they know the medical history of someone. So there are good reasons for that, for those restrictions to be
Absolutely.
In place. So it's an ongoing conversation we need to figure out.
But I think the point...
But there is value, there is merit in what's being said about the data. Having more data is, as long as you know who has access to what data.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Knowing about a specific person is more dangerous. If you know about a population, that tends to be better for a society.
Right.
So how you manage that is really the devil in the details.
It's tricky, of course, because, of course, in your medical file is information that gets really close to identifying you. You know, if people find all the medical information from the Santa Cruz County area and then they, find the 40-year-old white guy that with brown hair and hazel eyes and like all this information that slowly denotes who I am, it's easier. Maybe there's only 150 people of that nature in
unless
Sherry.
You're anonymizing most information about that, like the location, who the user is, stuff like that. And after you notice the pattern and start drilling down, you start noticing commonalities.
What I'm saying is that some of the valid data to pull would be how is the hospitals in the Santa Cruz County doing compared to Los Gatos area, you know, from San Jose area. And it's very true that if we had a discrepancy in some kind of disease, we'd want to address that. And the only way to look at that is to compare the two. I mean, because the population types are relatively similar to the two areas, but the hospitals are different, and therefore the medical treatment could be different, and you could see a side effect. Mm-hmm. So some great reasons to have this data brought up and collected.
Yeah, or for that matter, if there's a particular provider in an area, or different state or different county, where Southeast Asians, for example, were given a standard treatment, but it didn't work for them because of their genetic history.
Right.
As compared to Caucasians or to African Americans or to Latinos or to Native Americans, to know
that information suddenly becomes useful.
And because we do have some data as to how that affects people, not enough, but we have some data, but we don't necessarily know that one particular area hasn't gotten the memo yet.
Right. Well, what's clear to me is that, you know, a doctor's practice is called a practice, right? It's called a practice because they always have to work at it and get better and better and learn from their mistakes. And the best way we're learning right now, like the current state of great knowledge, there's a wonderful French term for it I'm totally blanking on, is large data analysis, right?
Yeah.
We're getting really good at that. And so it's time to potentially start looking at that. So I like that Larry Page is saying this. I get that it's kind of scary from some perspectives. I know a lot of Google employees that do not feel the company is actually a really awesome company, a great place to be, and that they're really doing good work. So in my mind, I kind of have some trust in there, but maybe I trust too much. But I do like the idea of us assessing it regularly and trying to figure out a better way to learn from our medical knowledge.
Well, we all trust individuals. We trust the people that we know, and that doesn't necessarily extend to the people that they know.
Right.
And so a good amount of skepticism is always a good thing.
Yeah.
And at the same time, not necessarily believing that, you know, some of these companies are the boogeyman is probably also a healthy thing as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like most people in most companies mean well. And often it's the structure of the company or who makes decisions or what group of individuals make different parts of decisions that get you into trouble.
Or what those individual participants' ideas of what meaning well means.
That's true, too.
That's actually where a good portion of it comes from, is just people disagreeing, having a different social outlook on things.
Yeah.
As opposed to malice, you know. Very few people are actively evil. They're simply working on different assumptions that you are.
All right, well, let's move on. I've lost track of whose turn it is, but I think it's Miles' turn. Miles, you want to talk about a bit of analysis?
Sure. I will talk about how solar power seems like it can, you know, work for our purposes. One of the things that we've talked about in the past on solar power is the fact that the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. It's hard to put them in roles that we refer to as baseline power. These are ones where coal, oil, natural gas, you know, petroleum products, or nuclear has taken the forefront, because there it doesn't matter what the weather's like. You just shovel more coal in the fires and you get the turbines running faster and you get more power. But what a group has done is taken a strong look at solar thermal, also known as concentrating solar power. And what they found is when you have some type of storage mechanism for that heat, so you have a sodium bath that you can heat up that has a good thermal mass, and you have some good regulation about how the power is coming in and going out, and you have some good efficiencies.
Let me clarify what this is. The solar arrays where you collect from mirrors sunlight and you aim it at one spot. You superheat something, and that thing becomes the thing you use.
Or you aim at a tube. You may have some parabolic where they're going to like something like mineral oil or something like that.
The idea is to use the sun to heat directly rather than going to electricity. You heat directly something that then you use for traditional types of electricity uses. So you were saying this materials.
Well, let's get a little bit, I mean, very little geeky, but how coal works is you throw it into a fire. The fire burns hot. The heat boils water into steam, and then the steam pressure turns a turbine. And
the turbine is connected to basically a motor, which generates electricity.
Right, exactly. And so what we're talking about here is the sun being the heat source, that you concentrate the sun's energy into a small point so that heats the water to generate steam to generate pressure.
So you're talking about the material that actually gets used to get heated. That material is important.
Yeah, well, you could just heat the water directly from the sun, but then as soon as the sun went down, you don't have any sun energy anymore, and you fizzle out. And that is really bad for baseline power. Baseline power means you want to be able to have people play their TVs and their Netflix at night.
And have, like, lights on at their house.
And have lights on.
And the refrigerator,
Still running. That's also very important.
So rather than store the energy, once you create the energy, rather than storing that in batteries, you store the energy before you've created it in terms of heat.
Then when you want to create a particular form, you don't transfer from thermal to electrical and then store as electrical. You store as chemical as batteries.
But going to the chemical is a loss, and then coming back out of the chemical reaction is a loss. So if we could just hold on to that heat for a little while. Mm-hmm. So this new study talks about possibly that's a possible way to do it.
Yes. Right? And an answer to folks who may talk about, well, why don't we just make battery technology better?
We've been trying.
But I want to give a statistic that is very sobering and will give you a really good idea of why that's not really a possibility. If you take all the batteries in the world today, uh-huh. every car battery, every battery that's in a Tesla, every D battery, all of those batteries, you take all of them in the world, they would run the Earth for 10 minutes.
Okay. Got it.
So not necessarily the ones that have been discarded in a landfill. I'm talking about the ones that are in active use right now.
That have a charge.
You take all of them, they power us for 10 minutes.
Right. It's a different scale.
Yes.
Yeah. Batteries are the most.
We're not even close.
As I recall, batteries are the most expensive means of energy possible. if you look at the amount of energy you can get from a battery and all
that. The reason we use them is that they are convenient.
They're portable.
Yes.
Amazing. So the idea here is instead you use a thermal, you use a giant mass and store the heat, mm-hmm. and then you continually run so it's really hot material. You run the water through it, which heats up the water, and that even happens till dawn, and when the sun comes up and can heat the system.
But someone's crunched the numbers,
and it's possible.
Our technology and our research have gotten us to the point where we actually can do this as baseline.
See, I'm pretty excited about this kind of methodology for producing electricity. The only issue, of course, is that you do have to have sunny environments because you do want most of the time to be sunny, and transporting electricity is still a big loss.
More than half of electricity in Germany is now done by solar, although most of them is by rooftops. It's not a centralized thing like it is in the U.S. So much. But very few parts of the U.S. get less sunlight than the average in Germany.
Wait, say that again?
Most of the U.S., the vast majority of the U.S., like greater than 90% of the U.S., continental U.S., gets more sunlight than on average than the average in Germany.
So you're saying Germany's doing it now. We're in a better position to do it, so we certainly could do it.
Yes.
We being
That's
the
exactly
United
what
States.
I'm saying, yes. Mm-hmm.
All right, cool.
Will it work in every area in the United States? No, but it will work in the vast majority of areas, especially where wind won't work, like in the southeast, or where photovoltaic won't work because the sun doesn't shine all day.
You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is KUSP in the air. With me is Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. Ben, Miles mentioned Germany.
Yeah, Deutschland. Well,
speaking of Germany and a lot of heat.
Yeah, right. That's true. So the German government has been using Verizon for some of their various internet services. And to be clear, this is not any of the German security or the German security agencies, but this is other government agencies. And they just came out and said, you know what? We've been reconsidering this Verizon contract, and we're not going to do it. We're not going to renew it. And the reason is, of course, because of the National Security Agency and because Verizon, well, here's the quote. It says, quote, there are indications that Verizon is legally required to provide certain things to the NSA, and that's one of the reasons the cooperation with Verizon won't continue. So,
interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, this comes in the wake of Edward Snowden basically revealing the extent of the eavesdropping by the NSA, and that the NSA targeted Angela Merkel, Chancellor Angela Merkel, and tapped her phone and all of that stuff.
Yeah, with Angela Merkel, that's definitely an issue. At the same time, let's give credit where credit is due.
Mm-hmm.
The NSA was brought before Congress. Do you spy on Americans? No! And then they did. Well, do you ever spy for economic reasons? No! And then they did. So this is the fallout that many companies have been worrying about, is that other countries just won't trust American companies not to be a conduit for this spying thing. And it's actually hurting us in terms of business opportunities.
Yeah, definitely.
Aside from the whole privacy issue.
Hey, so Facebook recently posted, 2 days ago, posted a blog, Fighting Bulk Search Warrants in Court. And they're just basically saying that sometimes, so Facebook has this general perspective that they look through every request for people private information with search warrants. They look to see if there's precedent, to see if the request is reasonable and all that. And this post article, this article talks about how they're fighting currently since last summer. I'll just quote the blog entry. Since last summer, we've been fighting hard against a set of sweeping search warrants issued by a court in New York that demanded we turn over nearly all data from accounts of 381 people who use our service, including photos, private messages, and other information. This unprecedented request is by far the largest we've ever received by a magnitude of more than 10, and we have argued that it is unconstitutional from the start. It's neat to see that these large tech companies are now just saying blatantly this is happening, because of course normally with these requests there's a gag of response of talking about the request.
You're not supposed to.
You're not supposed to say,
"Hey, right, we got this request."
So, in any case, you can see that companies are trying to protect our data to some degree. But at the same time, I mean, here's the opening paragraph, and coming from Facebook, it just seems a little disingenuous. Our goal is to protect people's information on Facebook. So when a government requests data, it's a big deal to us. Is their goal? Our goal is to protect people's information on Facebook. No, it isn't. Their goal is to profit from people's information on Facebook. Yes, they need to protect it so that we still trust them so that they can profit from it. But I wish it was a little more clear.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a secondary goal. That's not the goal.
Okay. Miles, let's see. It's actually, yeah, Miles, do you want to talk about these black holes? Because I skipped it earlier for me. Are you you're good? Or should we go ahead and take this call?
Let's take the call.
All right. Sounds good.
Ring, ring.
And I'm assuming, Jamie, from Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
I'm assuming, did you call an 888 number or an 800 number?
I called 476-2800.
You're local to Santa Cruz. All right. So if other people want to call in and they're not in Santa Cruz, the 831 area code, the phone number actually, yeah, I've been lying to you the entire time, is 800-655-5877, as it has been for 14 years of me doing the show. 800-655-5877. Okay, Jamie, what's your comment?
Okay, so I'll try to be clear here. I don't understand the Google medical discussion. As I understand it right now, when I go into a doctor's office in Arizona, they can pick up my PHI right away. So it's already all over.
But you're saying that
Google doesn't think it's all over. They're nuts.
No,
Are they saying they're trying to put it on their website instead of the insurance company's website? I don't understand.
Are you represented by a large insurance company?
A large insurance company.
Yes.
I am represented.
meaning, when you go to that other hospital,
is involved.
Yeah.
CalPERS is involved, which is the whole state's retirement system, and the local PMG HMO is involved. So all kinds of people are involved. All I know is when everyone I know goes to a new doctor they've never seen, the doctor can pull up the record.
So the
data is already out there, is what I'm saying.
So that transfer request happens because you give explicit information.
No. You walk into the doctor's office, he looks at it before he even talks to you.
The law that we were referring to earlier is very clear.
Well, I'm very familiar with HIPAA. I'm a provider.
Okay. So how would one doctor's office be able to get access to your medical information without your explicit expense?
HIPAA provides for inter-provider provision of information.
Right. Assuming you grant grant that transfer.
And it is assumed that when you present yourself for treatment that you so consented.
Right. So what we're talking about is being able to aggregately look at data. What you're talking about is transferring records. So we talked about two of these issues during the story we covered. One is the transfer of records between from one patient to two different providers. And the case that I was talking about was the home birth or the midwife and not being able to get to a traditional practitioner hospital. That transfer probably isn't set up. Most likely is the midwife organization doesn't have the same kind of system in place to transfer those records. One of the reasons for that is because of the HIPAA regulations making it very difficult to play in that space without a lot of time and energy and money invested, right? So
that was one of the things I was saying.
And the secondary thing we were talking about is being able to look at these records without the goal being to service the patient. Right, because
no, and that's
the individual
permitted by HIPAA. Also, what I'm trying to tell you is that because of the relatively easy transferability of the data, which already exists, and the fact that HIPAA itself provides for aggregating data, then it can already happen. Is what I'm saying.
It can happen by the providers, but not by external sources.
What are you talking about? What kind of internal sources are you talking about?
So we're talking about like multiple providers have their own records and of the patients that they're servicing, right? They've got those, and they can transfer them between the two, assuming the patient's being accessed the other facility. But no one is looking in aggregate at this data at a large scale.
How do you know? Because the insurance companies, in fact, do have all that data, and they have scientists. I don't understand why you assume it's not happening.
Okay, you've got me. I guess clearly I don't know enough about this topic at hand.
Well, I'm just suggesting. I'm not saying the insurance companies are that responsible, but if they're trying to lower their costs, I am assuming, and of course ask is the first part of assuming, that they have scientists that want to lower death rates, and therefore they do look at the aggregated data. But, you know, it could be because America screwed up that they don't do it. I don't know.
I think the issue at hand is that the reason why an insurance company wants to do something is about their business model and the data they have is part.
Certainly doesn't include people dying.
And their business model definitely has an idea that the data they have access to is valuable to them. Miles, were you going to say something?
I was going to say along those lines that the general health of the population is not the same thing as maximizing profits. That's actually a problem that we were having with the healthcare industry for quite a while.
Right.
Was that they were trading on the public. Public stock exchanges and doing very well, and it wasn't because people were getting healthier overall. It was because they were maximizing how many healthy people they could have in the system and minimizing the number of sick people they would have in the system.
Right. Therefore, what I would like to see is the scientist organization, health-interested scientists, ask the companies for access to the information, which they could probably provide under HIPAA for aggregate data analysis.
Yeah, so I wasn't saying that this aggregate data analysis can't happen under HIPAA. What I was saying is that because HIPAA exists, to play in this field is expensive and large corporations do it. There's not a lot of – there's some restriction in that space. That's what I was talking about. So we're not talking about aggregating the data and not being able to do it inside of HIPAA. I'm saying that HIPAA causes an environment in which it's difficult to do this kind of research.
Well, okay.
But there's nothing wrong with that. I think that we also talk pretty clearly that there's important reasons why HIPAA exists.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm just saying that I think the National Academy of Sciences should take some initiative, which I'm going to suggest to them, that they talk to the insurance companies and ask for the aggregated data.
Okay, there's an area where I do agree with Lyle. They can't just ask for it. That's one of the things that Google was talking about. And Google is, honestly, and along many other companies like them, there are data scientists.
That's what they do.
What the company is data analysis.
Yeah, but I'm not interested in Google doing it. I'm interested in scientists doing it. And my understanding of HIPAA is that HIPAA does permit the insurance companies to do aggregate science, and they could ask that they could delegate that under contract to the Academy of Sciences, and they could do it.
Okay, so the thing is, the science that's being done right now at this kind of large data science is being done by Facebook. It's being done by Google. That's where a lot of money in this kind of research is going. they have the money, they have the brain power, and they're doing that kind of research. We covered last week a great article about Facebook doing scientific research and submitting to a journal about emotional transfers.
The sticking point with regard to the story is whether or not we trust those companies enough to have that data, that they will be good stewards or not. Not whether or not they have the skills to do so, because I think it's pretty obvious from their resumes and from their backgrounds that they do have the chops for it.
Right.
It's not so much that it's not you have to go to a particular group like the National Academy of Sciences for that. I mean, you have people that are top of their league and some of them at that are members of the National Academy of Sciences working for these companies. But the question is whether or not you want to have these corporate entities as stewards of your data. That's the question
I would ask. I'd rather just it goes directly to the scientists, not have some intermediate organization.
But what I'm saying is that scientists are being employed by these companies. There's no magic
like science pool you can go to. You have to find the resources around. Somebody has to pay for the people to work. So what we're saying is that, National Academy of Sciences might be the right target at one point, but really if there's a large data company that can do this kind of work, it makes sense to empower them to do that.
One way to talk about this would be like the genome project that was done at UC Santa Cruz. Where it wasn't the biologists that made that happen. I mean, they did. They were the ones who were focusing on that. But what you had was actually an influx of computer scientists that were able to make it so that you had these algorithms that were going to take, decades, take the space of a few months instead, because they were data scientists. That's what their goal was. And it wasn't because they had anything to do with those same people go to work in the private sector. They go to work at companies.
My problem is that Google's business model is based on making money off of data mining and so forth. So I don't trust their motives to put the science first.
Right, and that's fair. We're talking about whether or not they were going to steward their ability level.
And I don't trust the insurance companies to do the same thing you just said, right?
That's why I'm going to ask the Academy of Science to take the initiative and make it public.
Okay.
Sounds good.
But that's just an idea.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jamie, for the call. Very enlightening.
Yeah, it seems like we were in vehement agreement there. We want the data out there and analyzed.
We're just having
a question of whether or not...
I think Jamie definitely spotted our lack of knowledge about HIPAA.
Yes.
I think we didn't cover that well, so I'm glad that he called in and informed us. So thank you very much. If you'd like to call in with... questions, you're welcome to do so. The phone number is 800-655-5877. Ben, you want to talk about parking?
Can I talk about my music story? I got a joke. How can you tell a programmer from a musician?
How?
What's a C sharp? C sharp is a language. C sharp is a musical note. So this is just kind of a silly feel-good story. Some person decided, I can make code with my computer keyboard, but they actually built a script where they can write code using their musical keyboard. So you can hit different keys for different notes. You can hit different keys for different snippets of code. It reminds me a lot of things that a lot of people have already done, which is basically you have this other additional device on your desk. Maybe it has some buttons, and you can press these buttons to simplify tasks that you normally would have to go through a lot of steps to do, like building, for example, or pulling or deploying or pushing if you're using version control or something like that. So the name of this project is Midichlorian, which is a little geek joke. It's a Visual Studio extension. If you write using Visual Studio, you can go to geekspeak.org and find it. But the really cool thing is actually someone actually put together a computer program in C sharp. This is called a Hello World, a suite for Visual Studio in C sharp minor. And you can go and play the sheet music. And if you were to play the sheet music into a keyboard, which is attached using this Visual Studio extension, it would actually write you a program which said Hello World.
That's kind of fun.
I don't know. It's kind of cute.
It makes sense as a teacher of programming and a musician. It totally makes sense.
There's also a YouTube video, so you can watch this 1 minute piece and you can watch the person playing it on the keyboard and watch as the program is being typed out. So,
calling from Santa Cruz, Lori, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. I think the discussion that you guys have been having about the medical data and how to aggregate and how to take out identifiers and how to do it within HIPAA's constraints. It's fascinating, and I think it would be great if you could get a show, maybe in combination with Ask Dr. Don, and got some medical people on along with your geek self, and really had a discussion about how this could work and how it should work and how it could work for our benefit without speculating about how it's done in some places or not done or could
sure.
be done.
I like it.
I think that would be totally cool, and I would be really happy to help with it if you ever wanted that.
Oh, so, I like the offerage of help too. That's good.
We were looking at doing that a long time ago, and it kind of fizzled.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely a thing we've always thought about. Dawn's such an amazing, mind. I'd love to do content with her. We've done it a couple times, but it'd be great to do that again. I'll talk to Dawn about it and Charlie about it. Would you mind, Lori, calling back the station and giving your information so we can include you in the planning?
No problem. I'd like to.
Thank you so much.
Bye bye.
Oh, that sounds fun.
This is the end of Geek Speak, as it is every week at this time. On the show today was Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. Miles, a real quick black hole closeout?
Sure. Supermassive black holes, the type of things that are center of galaxies. Turns out astronomers have found three of them in close proximity to one another.
Ooh.
Hijinks ensue.
Are they orbiting or collapsing?
They are orbiting.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So you can use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the Geek sent you. This is public radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. If you want to hear more about anything we talked about today on GeekSpeak, please feel free to visit us online at GeekSpeak.org. Miles, Ben, and Rick for answering phones. Thanks for joining me on GeekSpeak. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.